This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing your world of people and things. Here, paupers and peasants and princes and kings.
That's Bob Dylan, recorded in 1961 from his first album for Columbia Records. Chronicles, Volume 1, the first of Dylan's projected three-volume autobiography, has just been published. Our rock historian Ed Ward says that unlike many other rock memoirs, this is not a sex and drug confessional, and Ed liked it a lot.
Once upon a time, before the rock press existed, back when record companies didn't really understand how to market things, Bob Dylan's career began. All my friends had the same experience. You'd be walking past the record store, and there would be a new Bob Dylan album. You'd go buy it and take it home and play it, and you'd call your friends to tell them it existed. Hey, did you hear this new Bob Dylan album? And the response was always, how is it? The inevitable answer would be, I'm not sure yet. That was because you'd be overwhelmed by the sounds and images, and it took a while to sort them out. Well, there's a new Bob Dylan album, and it's a book. It's called Chronicles, Volume 1, the first apparently of three. Reading it, I had that old feeling again. I was impatient to finish it because I wanted to read it again, but meanwhile, I sure was having a good time. And just like those old world-rearranging albums, it's filled with unexpected twists, fascinating characters, and, as sort of a baseline, great American folk music. You probably won't be surprised to learn that it's not exactly linear. It starts and ends with Dylan in the office of Lou Levy, head of Leeds Music, the publisher he's been referred to by John Hammond, who just signed him to Columbia Records. Lou is munching on a cigar and signing the 19-year-old kid to a contract. In the last pages, the now 21-year-old kid has gone to Levy's office with $1,000 in his pocket to buy that contract out. Things have changed. In the nearly 300 pages in between, we're taken on a strange ride. The first section rambles around the folk scene in New York as Dylan found it when he arrived, with characters like Richie Havens, Tiny Tim, and Fred Neil, and especially the man he idolized and sort of feared, Dave Van Ronk, the Eminence Grise of the village folk singers. He needed to be won over if Dylan was to have a career, and he eventually was. The next section is longer and shows Dylan settling into life in New York in the apartment of Ray Gooch and Chloe Keel, two larger-than-life characters he's been introduced to by a folk singer named Paul Clayton. The apartment is as much a character as its occupants. It seems to have a library where the knowledge-hungry young Dylan can find everything and more, and he describes discovering Thucydides, Milton, Robert Graves, Balzac, books of poetry, and art books. Having gotten a steady gig at the Gaslight, home base of the folk scene, he's also discovering the village, its movie houses and cafes and parties, at which he meets a variety of people from all walks of life. Dylan's writing makes the excitement palpable, and the last sentences are right on the money. The future was nothing to worry about. It was awfully close. Next, it's 10 years later, and he's been asked by the poet Archibald MacLeish to write some songs for a play MacLeish had written called Scratch. Dylan's pretty much had it with success in the counterculture and is much more interested in being a father and keeping away from fans who sound like an army of zombie vampires. The MacLeish project falls through, but Dylan salvages the songs he'd started writing for an album called New Morning. And suddenly it's 16 years later, and the book's longest section, which goes on and on about an incomprehensible system he learned from the guitarist Lonnie Johnson that he says revolutionized his performances and the making of the album Oh Mercy. I found this part the hardest to read because this album went right past me. Finally, it's 1961 again, and we're treated to some detailed reminiscences of Dylan's childhood, his breaking into the folk scene in Minneapolis, his discovery of Woody Guthrie, the songwriter who changed his life, and his sponge-like absorption of influences from his fellow folkies' record collections, all leading inevitably to New York and Lou Levy's office. But just summarizing the contents is a bit like saying, oh, there's a song about working on Maggie's farm and one about the Gates of Eden and one to Mr. Tambourine Man. On the other hand, the book is hard to quote briefly because, like those classic songs, the prose works by adding details, both personal ones and details of the cultural milieu Dylan affected and was affected by. His personal likes, Dave Guard of the Kingston Trio, Frank Sinatra Jr., and Johnny Rivers, can really catch you by surprise, as can his frankly admitting to being afraid of Joan Baez after hearing her first record. His candor, too, about both being aware of how little he knew about things and how little he cared about some aspects of his career, is refreshing. He comes off as a very humble person, albeit one with a great deal of determination. If you're a Bob Dylan fan, or if you have any interest in the part he's played in American society, you're just going to have to read this. There's a surprise on every page, and two more volumes to come. If they're this good, they'll be worth the wait.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed Chronicles, Volume 1, the first of a projected 3-volume Bob Dylan autobiography.